Have you ever wondered what it would feel like to write a book the whole wide world loves? This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. I'm Linda Sievertson, and my guest called in from her home in England last week on her novel's publication day here in the States. Rosie Walsh is her name, and even if you haven't heard of her yet, you likely know a little something about her topic. The name of this book is Ghosted, and here's the gist. 7 perfect days, then he disappeared. A love story with a secret at its heart. I say this is a book for everyone for 2 reasons. First, I think most of us here have been ghosted, either by a lover, a new crush, even a friend. It turns out it's pretty universal having someone you care for just bail without explanation. They disappear. They enact the big fade away. Which brings me to my second point. Because we've all either been there or fear being ghosted, 31 countries, you guys, have inked deals with Rosie and her agents to publish this book, including a 13-way bidding war in Germany alone. Yeah, it's that beautifully written. Which brings me to me. When Rosie's publicist at Penguin Random House, Heather Mill, reached out to me about Ghosted, I wanted to step away from the hype and be really certain that I too loved the book before I said yes. Rosie's editor, Pamela Dorman, who has her own imprint at Viking Penguin and legendary taste and talent. She's published global bestsellers like Bridget Jones' Diary and The Secret Life of Bees, Queen Sugar, Me Before You, and so many others. But I still had to feel it for myself. Obviously, Rosie's here, which means the book lived up to every bit of the buzz. After bawling my eyes out at several points in the book, I knew I had to bring her on and ask her how she pulled this off. How does someone who's never taken a single creative writing class or even listened to a lecture on creative writing, how do they write such a page-turner? I had a feeling Rosie could articulate the how beautifully, and she does. As does our guest co-host today, Aditi Khurana, who is also a Penguin Random House author and also a page-turning goddess. Aditi is a dear friend and has just this past week completed a new novel, so I'm so grateful she could crawl out of her writing cave for this convo. Both ladies have a history in television, Rosie in documentaries, Aditi as a journalist who's worked at CNN, ABC News, and PBS, and also in entertainment marketing at Sony, Fox, and Paramount. In other words, super smart and sassy sisters. Aditi is the author of 2 critically acclaimed young adult novels, which we'll talk about. She writes about feminism, colonialism, race, class, and belonging. Her TEDx talk about the process of writing Mirror in the Sky is called Harnessing the Power of the Unknown. And I don't know, someone here may have recently gotten her first tattoo inspired by one of her books. Maybe we'll get to that. First, I have asked Rosie to read a bit for us from Ghosted to kick us off. Seeing as how it's her U.S. birthday and all, I know she's so grateful for the gift of your time. And I hope you will consider buying this book as well as a gift to yourself. Welcome.
"You," he said quietly. He traced a finger along my hairline. "I like you. I like you and me. In fact, I like you and me very much." I smiled right into those kind, sincere eyes, at those laughter lines at the heavy angle of his chin. I took his hand and kissed his fingertips, rough and mottled with splinters after 2 decades of woodworking. Already it felt like I'd known him for years, for a lifetime. Felt like someone he'd matched us, maybe at birth, and nudged and aligned and planned and schemed until we finally met 6 days ago. "I just had some very mushy thoughts," I said after a long pause. "Oh, me too," he sighed. "It feels like the last week's been set to a score of sweeping violins." I laughed, and he kissed my nose, and I wonder how it was that you could spend weeks, months, years even, just chugging along, nothing really changing. And then, in the space of a few hours, the script of your life could be completely rewritten. Had I gone out later that day, I would have got straight on the bus and never met him, and this new feeling of certainty would be no more than an unheard whisper of missed opportunities and bad timing.
Rosie, Aditi, I'm so grateful you're both here. I've been looking so forward to this.
Hi, Rosie.
Hello, everyone. This is just so exciting. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh. And Aditi, you're here for her debut day. This is birthday.
I'm so excited. Book birthdays and just general birthdays are my favorite. So I'm very, very excited to be here.
Well, and you're both
is it okay that I'm drinking champagne?
Oh, I wish I had champagne. It's 10 a.m. in LA, so it's a little early for me, but I'll catch up at some point. Definitely later today.
Have you had champagne yet, Rosie?
No. I was just handed a glass at 6 o'clock. I think prior to 6 might have been a little bit questionable, but 6 feels fine. Beautiful summer evening here in Bristol in the UK. Champagne. It's my US pub day. It would have been rude not to, I think.
So tell me, what does pub day look like for you across the pond? What has your day been like?
Well, it's been different, of course, because obviously when I have publication day in the United Kingdom, I'm surrounded by lovely warm wishes from my author friends. And of course, I don't really know anyone in literary terms in the States yet. So it's not quite the same, but I've had so many lovely shout outs online. I started the day with a flower delivery from my wonderful agent, Alison Hunter, at Janklo & Nesbitt. Got the day off to a very good start. And I then spent a while frantically making last-minute adjustments to my website so that any incoming readers or, you know, potential readers would be able to see Ghosted first and foremost, because obviously it's come out in many territories. So, I wanted to make sure it was very prominent there. I then did a couple of social media posts. I did a little boomerang for Instagram of me holding the book, which my nanny took, whilst we were both trying to distract my child from... He photobombed it several times, but we eventually managed to do one that he didn't photobomb. And then I have been doing radio and podcast interviews since early lunchtime. So actually, I've been confined to my bedroom for most of it. I'm sitting here with a fan because it's boiling hot. And because it's never hot in the UK, nobody has aircon. And as I said, yes, I'm drinking champagne.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, Rosie, seeing as how you've written novels under a different name, you've been a columnist, a dating columnist for Marie Claire, and now your first novel under your real name has been purchased by, 31 languages already?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so we have loads of writing questions at DT and I, but first, I have to ask you, have you ever been ghosted?
Oh my gosh, of course I have.
Who hasn't?
I think the first time I was 14, it was 1994, and it was very painful. I kissed a boy at a disco to Unchained Melody, and I thought that was it. You know, we were going to marry, never heard from him again, and then just sort of hung out in my local town on the following Friday night, hoping that he might turn up. He did, holding the hand of another girl.
Oh, so been there.
Oh, man, I was broken. My poor teenage heart, I was crushed. And in the interim, whilst I waited for that Friday night to come around, I think it was 2 weeks later, actually, because I hadn't been able to go out the weekend prior to that. But I spent basically 2 weeks stationed by my parents' telephone, just hoping desperately that he would call. Yeah. And, you know, of course, he didn't. My most painful ghosting, I think, as an adult was when I was about 27. And I just met a really gorgeous man. And I'm sure some of your listeners may judge me for this, but I took him home with me. And we just had the best day afterwards. It was just the most fun. I just felt such a connection. And we were talking about all sorts of things. And he invited me to a festival. And, oh, my gosh, you know, extensive passionate kisses at the doorstep when he left. Never heard from him again. And I guess that's not so much a ghosting, that's just, you know, I guess to him it was just a good little one-nighter, but I was absolutely gobsmacked. I could not believe that intensity of feeling could have existed between the two of us, and I'm sure I wasn't making it up, and that he would then within 24 hours decide and move on. It was awful.
Yeah.
So, yes, of course, I've been ghosted. You know, there have been many other times, too. It sadly seems to be quite a universal experience.
Oh,
for men and women, I should say.
Yep.
So I think, it's not easy dealing with someone else's emotional fallout, is it? It's easier to just be... Well, I have to say, I would never ghost. I have never ghosted anyone. I've always dealt with things properly. I've never just disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, Linda, I know you've been ghosted because that's what your iPhone app is all about, right?
Oh, geez, Lord in heaven. Yeah, Rosie, I won't belabor but my husband, after 19 years, bailed. He bailed for another woman, but he didn't actually disappear because we had a house and bills, and I had to be able to find him.
Yeah.
He moved far away, but at least I knew where he was. But then I fell in love with this super handsome stranger who literally was a stranger. And super broken me is like, hey, why don't you just move in? I'll take care of you.
Oh, good. Yep, I do.
Isn't that a good idea to move in a stranger? Yeah. So, and he just disappeared one night in the middle of the night. But what was interesting in my case is that I had kept a diary with the husband because we were really off and on and it was hard to figure things out. But I did erase entries when we were getting along because I felt kind of guilty about feeling my own feelings and knowing what they were. So with the new guy,
things we do.
Right? So with the new guy, I was like, okay, how do I avoid that awful situation? Well, I'll just keep a diary and never erase it. But the problem, Rosie, with that one was I couldn't decipher the entries because they were, one day was beautiful, one day was horrifying. I couldn't figure out, did we have more bad than good? So I started color coding the entries, and that's when everything changed. The blinders came off, complete clarity, better than therapy. So I did create an app. It's called The Boyfriend Log. It's free. Anybody can download it. But it definitely helps you not to be in denial because where your book is different, we're going to talk about that. The disappearance was different in your book. The reality in real life is that people do disappear, and there are often signs, not always, but there are often telltale signs that we want to deny or ignore because we want love. And we
it's a slow fading, life. Isn't it? No, I looked the app up. I think it's a fantastic idea. And color coding your sort of emotional experience with your partner each day is, I think, a fantastic tool for anyone, whether they're in the early or late stages of their relationship. And, you know, and as you say, it's set there in stone. You can look at it and know immediately. It's like post-it note plotting a novel, isn't it? You look at it and you go, I haven't got enough blues in this bit, so I'm going to need to put a blue post-it note, you know, a red herring or something. There's something infallible about rows and rows of colours in front of you. It's a lot harder to lie to yourself, I guess.
Thank you.
It sounds like a wonderful tool for emotional health, I think a lot of us could do with. Probably don't give it to new parents, though, because all of those days are going to be red for a long time.
Right? Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know what's interesting is I right now am in the middle of a couple of books, and you know how you get so involved in what you're doing that you don't really think about your past stuff. So thank you for mentioning that, Aditi, because I read this entire book, Ghosted, without thinking. I actually created an app to help women avoid this very thing, people disappearing. But anyways.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe you didn't even think of that. Because
didn't
I think
even think
it's just
of
sort
it.
Of like such a commonality between your book, Rosie, and all the stuff that you've been working on, Linda, that we've talked about. Just the idea. I love stories about people taking their own pain and the pain that they see in the world and then using it personally for their art. And so I think, Linda, your experience has helped, I don't even know, like thousands of people, and you haven't even released a book about it. And Rosie, I'm sure you're getting countless stories about women who have gone through this experience of ghosting that's so demoralizing and disillusioning, and just finding comfort in the world that you've created.
I came to the States on a pre-publication publicity tour in April, I think it was, and I met a whole load of folks, booksellers and media, in four cities, and I don't think I'll ever forget a conversation that I had with one bookseller, and I won't even say where she lives, but it was absolutely awful. It was her own personal ghosting story with somebody with whom she was in, you know, a very committed relationship that had been going on quite a while. And when finally he reappeared again, somehow convinced her to go back out with him, and then it happened again. And it's one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever heard. And she sort of became embarrassed at one point and said, oh, gosh, sorry, you're a stranger. I shouldn't be saying this to you. But I sought her out afterwards and wrote to her and said, thank you so much for sharing that with me, because that intensity of emotion, and I think most people feel that intensity of emotion when they've been ghosted, whether it's a really awful thing, whether the relationship's been going on for months, if not years, or even, you know, if they've only had a few dates. Because I think if you allow yourself to invest in a future with somebody, and then you discover at the same moment that they're not just cruel and rude and lazy and disrespectful, but that they're not the one and that you have no future with them. It's just too much for most people to take in. I think it's an incredibly painful experience. And I think most of us are dismayed by the intensity of our feelings when it does happen. You know, we sort of feel that we should have more of a handle on ourselves and shouldn't be so upset because we haven't known them that long. But there are so many factors combined in being ghosted, I guess. You know, it's the sort of sudden, you know, some sense of rug being pulled from under your feet and the sudden loss of what you thought was control and the ability that we all have now to sort of stalk each other obsessively online, which, of course, only leads to further misery, no matter what we find. And I guess, you know, for most of us, the only thing that would console us would be to find out that they're dead, and that's not really a great result either, is it? So there's no good use of social media in this instance, I don't think.
Well, I was thinking about that so much as I was reading it, because I was like, rejection is such a primal sort of pain, and it's like the pain of abandonment, and I was thinking about the fact that there's, without giving away too much, there's a tragedy at the core of this novel. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think love and pain are so intrinsically intertwined? And what's the relationship between our passions and our wounds?
Interesting question. I guess it's the intensity of feeling. You know, love and tragedy are the only things that we feel as intensely as each other. You know, I can feel all sorts of joy and excitement and envy and frustration and rage, but none of those feelings are anywhere near as intense as grief or love. Even though they're at opposite ends of the spectrum, I guess they're very interdependent, aren't they? It's the allowing yourself to feel emotion on that scale in whichever direction. And I guess, of course, another way in which you're interdependent is that when you fall in love, you suddenly have a lot to lose.
Oh, yeah.
And there's that omnipresent fear. I mean, even if you're a really positive person, I think there will always be an omnipresent fear of losing that. But I guess to lose it unexpectedly and without any explanation is, you're not just dealing with heartbreak, you're dealing with deep humiliation as well. And shock.
Shock, for sure. PTSD. All sorts of things.
Yeah.
Well, and it makes you, you know, anytime that you find out that you're potentially living a lie, it's very crazy making in that you start reliving years and years of plot lines of your own life going, okay, was that real? Or that's why he didn't kiss me that day. Or that's why he mentioned her name in that weird situation. Or you start piecing things together and it makes you batshit crazy.
It does make you batshit crazy. And underneath all of it suddenly appears a narrative of, I am unlovable.
Yeah.
I am deeply unlovable. Which, of course, is not true. You know, being unlovable to one person that's certainly does not make you universally unlovable. But it's very hard to shift that narrative, I think, when you're in the early throes of such a particularly cruel type of rejection.
It's so true. You know, my sister helped me so much. I was editing a scene recently in my memoir, which I'm not ready to release, but there's a scene where my sister calls me up and she says, Linda, because I felt unlovable and desperately wanted to believe I could find a man to be happily married to again one day. And she said, Linda, let me ask you something. I want you to write down the five reasons, the five main reasons why you feel unlovable. So I'm like, okay, I'm haggard, I'm old, I'm out of shape, you know, all the things, because I had been sitting on my butt for 12 weeks finishing a book. And so I was, you know, I hadn't worked out. I basically just looked and felt like hell. So she had me write all these things. I've got too many dogs. I've got a pissed off kid. Like, here are all the reasons why nobody, right? Here are all the reasons why nobody will ever date me again. So my sister goes, okay, let's start at the top. So you're haggard and tired. Let me ask you, do you think any man has ever married a woman who was haggard and tired? And I was like, well, yeah. She goes, okay. So you've got a pissed off kid and a bunch of dogs. So you think that makes you maybe unavailable, right? You've got other responsibilities. Do you think any man has ever married a woman who's been unavailable? Like, do you think people in prison ever get married? And I'm like, well, yeah. And she goes, okay, so you're out of shape. Do you think people who are out of shape ever get married? And I was like, yeah. And so she basically just shot a hole in every single one of my reasons. She's like, Linda, people 50 pounds, 100 pounds overweight get married. People in prison get married. People with five children, two of them autistic and one of them in a wheelchair, get married. She's like, stop it. There is no situation you can tell me that makes you unlovable.
It is quite amazing the criteria that we hold in our heads about what does and does not make us lovable.
Right.
Most of it's just bullshit. Most of
it. Right. Okay, so I have a writing question. Rosie, when you start writing a plotty book like this one, do you have all the plot points in mind or do they emerge as you write?
Well, as ever, as I'm sure you know, it's a combination of both. This novel, a lot more planning went into this one than others that I've written. And I say a lot more. That makes it sound like I spent weeks plotting it. And I actually didn't. I think because once I'd figured out why Eddie hadn't called, it all kind of fell into place. And so my post-it note plotting sessions only took 3 days, whereas they can take weeks sometimes. And I think that's partly because it was just a book that I was meant to write. But of course, as I'm sure you know, it doesn't matter what your intentions are. Sometimes your best laid plans are appalling. And so there are many storylines. There's a woman called Kaya who appears in the book later on, and there were all kinds of storylines involving her, all of which got scrapped. and I thought they'd had all sorts of dramatic tension. Oh, gosh, they were absolutely awful. And there were many scenes with ancillary characters, actually, that I scrapped because they were unnecessary. They detracted from the tension, whereas when I was plotting it, they, good Lord, they felt so important.
Yeah.
And even as I was writing them first draft, I thought, oh, wow, yeah, it's so important that I get this out and the other. And then, you know, most of them I took out myself. Some of them, either my UK or my US editor just, you know, crossed them out in track changes. And the first time I saw entire chapters being crossed out, my heart would be in my throat. It's like, oh my God, what are you doing? but actually, of course, they were always right. And with all of them, I just said to myself, just try it. Just try it and see how it reads. And surprise, surprise, it read well. And I have a writing partner, and I remember her saying to me, because she's not yet published, she will be very soon, I'd imagine. She's an outstanding writer. But I remember her saying to me, I can't believe you're so willing to take all of these things on board. You know, some of them seem so brutal. But I think when I look at myself, who has completed 5 novels, and then I look at Pam, who is my US editor, who must have edited hundreds and hundreds of novels, many of them major global bestsellers.
Right.
I sort of think she's probably more on the money than I am. So that's my rule. Just give it a go. Leave it there for a few days. And if you cannot stop thinking about it, then put it back in.
That's great advice. Pam Dorman Books is your imprint at Penguin Random House. And Pamela did, oh gosh, she's done Maria Shriver's book. We have Maria on in February. Pam is an amazing editor. So God bless. I mean, you are so blessed to have signed with her.
I know. I still can't believe it. I didn't know anything really about the US publishing industry before all of this happened. I never expected to get a US book deal. But actually, even I had heard of Pam. She's so legendary. And I spent 2 or 3 days talking to editors, what felt like all of the editors in New York. I'm sure it wasn't, but a great deal of them, about the book. And I think within about 10 seconds on the phone with Pam, I just knew, and I just thought, oh my God, I really hope it works out with this woman. She's amazing. Obviously, I didn't say that to her. I'm trying to sound, you know, catty and upbeat and very intelligent.
Sure, sure.
But she just, I just had a sense with her that she knew so much, and she connected enormously, you know, with the emotional core of this book. I guess that, yeah, you know, that had to happen. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been, yeah, on the phone. But I just felt that with her, I would be in incredibly safe hands. And so when it did work out that it was her who won the book, so to speak, I was absolutely thrilled. And
oh my God,
and she was everything I hoped for and more, actually. I learned more with my initial 6-week edit with her than I probably had in 8 years writing full time. She is an incredibly incisive, thoughtful editor and just has this incredible ability to just drill down to the core of everything and to just cut out all of the surrounding crap, which never feels like crap, of course.
It never does, right, right.
No, but it is.
Then you read it when it's gone and you think, oh, wow, this is clean. Mm. This is a page-turner,
so clean.
Before it wasn't a page-turner.
No, no. And, you know, occasionally, and it always blows my mind that people do this, but occasionally I'll be tagged in a negative review. And I should make clear, I don't mind having people reviewing my book negatively. That's completely fine. I'm always a little surprised to be tagged in those kind of posts. So, really? Why? I didn't need to read this, but thanks. But, yeah, you know, occasionally I'll be tagged in a negative review and, you know, people will say, oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't find it very interesting. I don't know why people keep saying it's a page-turner. But actually, had I submitted it before Pam's edit, you know, had it been published in that state, I'm pretty sure I would have been getting a lot of reviews like that rather than just a small handful. It's clean is the precise word. It felt so clean once she'd finished with it. It didn't feel like there was a word out of place.
Oh, sure. Well, I want to talk about getting your book deal and your past books and all that. First, though, Aditi, I want to know, when you're doing a plotty book, do you have your plots in mind? Because Aditi, I don't know, Rosie, if you've had a chance to see Aditi's work, but her novels, Mirror in the Sky and Library of the Fates and others that haven't been published yet, are total riveting page-turners. In fact, Aditi, I'm going to tell them about my tattoo, if it's okay.
Oh, my gosh. I know.
Okay, so Rosie, I've never had a tattoo, never wanted a tattoo, always thought, who would do that to their beautiful body, right? So one day, fiance's out of the house, dogs are all quiet. It was one of those perfect Sundays where I just sat in the sunroom against a beanbag overlooking the mountains with a book. I had Library of the Fates, Aditi's last novel, in my hands, a penguin book like yours. And I had heard great things, hadn't had time to read it, but I had 10 hours and I thought, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to read the whole thing. And I was so moved, just like I did at the end of your book. I was bawling my eyes out. And there have been two books in my life where I finished them, now three, because yours is now in there, but two books, now three in my life where when I finish, I think, I have to remember this feeling. Like, this is the feeling of if I could write like this, I could die happy. This is that feeling.
Oh,
and
wow.
I felt it with Eat, Pray, Love. I felt it with Library of the Fates. So I grabbed a Sharpie and I wrote on my wrist, remember, dot, dot, dot. Just remember. And I thought, I have to remember this feeling because this is why I write. This is why I read. It's so infrequent, but when it happens, I have to remember. So every day it would start to fade and I would rewrite it, remember. And then finally, after 6 months, I was at a Carmel writing retreat and a gal that comes every year who I worship, she had a tattoo on her wrist. I said, I want to do that. She goes, well, I want to add to mine. So we went off and did it together. And just that's what I want to remember all the time. So Aditi, knowing how much I love your novel.
That is a dream story that you want to hear when someone reads
it. I know. Can you imagine having that effect on somebody?
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Yeah. So Aditi, back to you. Do you have your plot points in mind or do they emerge as you write?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like I do, and I do this outlining process, but I outline till the very end. And so I never know how my novels are going to end, which is like a really nightmarish way of writing. I don't recommend it. I don't think it's the best way of doing things.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel like there's something about writing a novel that does transform you. And by the time I get to the end, I know what it's going to be. And the times where I've plotted till the very end, the end that I had in mind is never the actual end of the book.
Right.
And so, yeah, I plot up until, I would say, the last couple of chapters. And then it kind of reveals itself to me, usually right away. And sometimes it takes like a couple of months and then I have to sort of sit on it. But that's usually my process.
I watched you sit on this one, but it's only been a couple of weeks and you did it. You nailed the ending on the new one.
Yeah, but I really made myself crazy. I was like, oh my God, I have 400 pages of a novel and now I have to scrap the whole thing. But I think you sort of have to sit on it sometimes. It's there. If you've plotted well, if you've plotted the rest of the book well, I think the conclusion makes sense. It's already organically in there. You just have to find it. It's almost like excavating. It becomes this like archaeological experiment where you do all the legwork and you do all the technical stuff. And then the magic is kind of at that moment.
That's a lovely, lovely metaphor, a dig. But it's true, I had a similar one with mine, except it took, gosh, I don't know, 7 or 8 months to find the correct ending. In that time, I ditched 120,000 words, which is pretty painful. But it was always there. And actually, even though at times I thought, oh, God, I don't know if I can carry on with this. My editor was certain that actually I could and that the ending was there and it was just a question of keeping on going, just sifting through.
Did you say that you ditched 120,000 words?
I'm afraid that's the whole book. Yeah, that's... I know. It was awful.
Wait, can you explain that? Because I'm still agog.
So from the point at which the reader discovers what happened to Eddie, there's about 40,000 words, I think. Yeah, probably it was originally 40, but my US editor chopped out many words, so it would have been about 40. And I rewrote those first 40,000 words myself first, completely scrapping what had come before, not using a single word of it, because I just could tell that the pace, the jeopardy, nothing, that nothing about it sort of honored the pace of the first two-thirds. Didn't work. Sent it to my editor anyway, hoping that she would just be like, yeah, great, yeah, that's fine. And I wouldn't have to work on it anymore. She didn't say that. She, rather than emailing me her thoughts, she just sent me an email saying, are you free to talk on the phone?
I hate that.
Shit. Yeah, it was not a great moment. And needless to say, yes, her feedback was, yeah, it really doesn't work. I mean, she said it very nicely, but, you know, the sentiment was the same. And so I did it again for her and found that I had to completely scrap those 40,000 words again. And sent it to her. And then she sent another email saying, free for a phone chat. So I did it again. And once again, there was almost pretty much maybe a couple of hundred words in that 40,000 words that I could salvage. And so in total, that was 120,000 words chopped out. In addition to the sort of 9 or 10,000 words that Pam, my US editor, chopped out, and in addition to, of course, all of the other words that you know, that you chop out as an author when you're making your own passes at it. So, yeah, it's heavily edited, but there's about 3 novels worth of outtakes, if anyone wants them.
My God, it's amazing to hear that, to think how a book ever effing makes it into a store. I mean, that is insane, but it's not totally unusual. When we interviewed Danielle and I interviewed Mary Carr, and I forget which book she was talking about. I think it was Liar's Club. She said she spent 9 months on the first chapter, and then at a certain point, she threw away, I want to say, I have to go back and look at the transcript, but I want to say it was like 120,000 words. And she said she was desperate. She was in her underwear, like pacing and pissy mad and so, so miserable. She said all she could do was just watch Oprah every day. And you know, then it took a huge amount of time to rewrite, and she had thrown it away completely gone. It wasn't like she even had it in a vault somewhere where she could look at it and mine it for tasty bits. It was dead.
It's such an act of blind faith, I think, writing. And, you know, it's sort of like you, this is a much more common story. And this actually makes me feel better, because when I was reading your book, I was like, this is so perfectly plotted. And
I know.
It was so clean. It was so perfectly. But it's almost good to know that this is just sort of an organic process for everybody. We all throw away so many words, and we all throw away so many precious words that we've worked so hard on. And it's excruciating. It's really, really difficult.
It is. And I think the only thing that we can really do as authors is to find ways of not caring. And I think so many of us have got quite a good way into a novel and then just thought, oh, no, just not working. But the reluctance to give up and start again is completely paralyzing. You know, I've probably written entire books I should never have written because, you know, I probably knew early on. But the horror that we experience of ditching any of our hard-written words is really intense. So I guess for most of us, the real learning would be to find ways of replacing that horror with something more constructive and welcoming. So that's no small task.
Oh,
I certainly haven't managed that.
So, Rosie, it sounds like you already had your book deal with Pam when all of this killing of your darlings was happening. And this was no small book deal. What I read in Publishers Marketplace, and if you listeners are not members of Publishers Marketplace, you need to be, because it's amazing day-to-day, up-to-date, cutting-edge information on the publishing world. And when I saw the deal that you got a major deal. And so you got the brass ring of deals with Pam Dorman. Are you saying that after that, after your advance, you were scrapping 120,000 words?
No, before. And I don't think I would have got that deal had I not done that painful work. I think with Pam, I probably shed about 10,000 words. But the incredibly painful cutting came before that. And actually, for that reason, I owe my UK editor, Sam Humphreys, a huge debt of gratitude, because I don't think this would be a book that would have sold around the world had she not sent me back to the drawing board again and again. She did it very nicely, but very firmly.
Oh, so you had the deal in England first?
Yes. So I got my UK deal, I got on a partial manuscript because she fell in love with it very early, which was obviously lovely. But then I delivered an ending that she wasn't happy with again and again. So, of course, I felt terrible because she takes quite a risk. Buying a book on a partial manuscript is a big leap of faith for any publisher.
That's why they don't do it. Right.
Well, exactly. That's why they don't do it. And she did it. And I disappointed her again and again. So I think in many ways, I find it more stressful because of that. Just thinking she's going to be thinking, oh, my God, why did I buy this bloody author? She's terrible. Of course, that's not what she was thinking at all. She just thought, I want to make this book outstanding. But no, it was largely thanks to that extensive cutting that I think editors like Pam and my other editors around the world read that and thought, oh, yeah, that's what I want.
I got it. And then how did you go from the UK deal to having an agent at Jenklow & Nesbitt in the United States, which is one of the biggest agencies we've got?
So I, from the very beginning of my career, I have had a US agent, Alison Hunter. And she
was Lucy Robinson, your other name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which we haven't talked about yet.
Sure, there's time. she was at Inkwell when I first agreed, you know, when we first agreed to work with each other. And she really wanted to find an American home for my Lucy Robinson novels. And my God, she tried so hard with each and every one. And there was a whiff of possibility with my third novel, much of which was set in New York, but it never really went anywhere. I think people felt that my voice, the feedback that we just kept getting was that my voice was too British. I think what by that they particularly meant the humor. And even though there's humour in Ghosted, it's not at the core of the novel in the way that it, I think humour was with my Lucy Robinson books. Yeah. So I've known Alison for years and years, you know, to the point she really has just become a great friend. And she never gave up on me. And when we were ready to go out on submission, she had recently just taken a job at Janklow Nesbitt. So I imagine they were pretty happy with her that she pulled that deal off so soon after she transferred. So, I mean, I didn't really know who were the big players over there. All I knew is that I was just still working with Alison, who I'd been working with for years. But in the interim, she'd sold all sorts of books and become a very successful agent. And so when this happened, I don't think, well, I'll never thank her enough. She was just quite incredible. She worked so hard on that submission. She did it so cleverly. She came up with so many brilliant ideas, including the title, Ghosted. I really don't know if it would have come to pass in the same way without her, even though it would have been the same book.
So, Rosie, you were writing under a pen name with your other books, right?
Yeah, I used to write under a pen name because when I first started out as a writer, I was writing a dating column for Marie Claire. And I couldn't really use my own name because obviously who was going to go on a date with me if they looked me up and discovered that they were going to be appearing in Marie Claire the next day. So I had to think of a pseudonym and I had only a couple of seconds to do it. I was in the middle of quite a quick email conversation with the online editor of Marie Claire. And I just thought, oh, what name shall I use? And I just used the name of my childhood friend who I used to play with. She lived next door. And didn't really think anything of it. You know, I certainly wasn't expecting when I started that blog to become an author. It hadn't even crossed my mind. And so when I did get a book deal, there were quite extensive conversations with my publishers about whether it made sense to publish me under my own name or to keep the pseudonym. And I think we all agreed that there was value in keeping the pseudonym because people knew that name. You know, I had a good following when I was writing for Marie Claire. And even if that only sold 1,000 books, it would be silly to miss out on that opportunity. And, you know, actually, it really worked for me having a pseudonym. I was writing books I wouldn't necessarily, I don't know if I'd have written those books had I just set out under my own name. So it was actually really nice to keep all of that separate. And then when I wrote this one, which felt quite different, to just kind of think, right, okay, it's time to do this under my own name. This is my book. This really comes from my heart. And it's time to put my own name on the front. It just all sort of worked really, really smoothly, actually. Although it was my agent's idea to put this out under my own name on submission.
Wow. Because your other books were dating, they were internet dating and romance, but they were good. I've heard other reviewers say that they were page turners. Obviously, you don't write Ghosted so beautifully without having serious chops. So it's not like those books were throwaways. So it's just really interesting. I've never run into somebody with such a strange sort of arc in their career.
Career trajectory. Yeah, there was a very clear transition as each book came out in a way that I wrote. The advice that I was given when I wrote the first Lucy Robinson book was to just kind of keep it as similar to my dating column as possible because that was a formula that really worked for young women. It was very funny. It was modern. It was sort of a dating column for the sort of modern thinking women. I was not a blogger who had lots of pairs of high heels and designer clothes. And I was just, I was a normal girl with a television career. A normal life and, you know, an appalling love life living in London. It was very much a book for people like me. But at its core, I felt the need to keep humour and dating and love and romance. And that's not necessarily what I would have written had I set out on my own without that column. And that's not a criticism at all. I'm very proud of what I did under my pseudonym. But as each book passed, I just got closer and closer to my natural voice, and there was quite a progression, and my publishers had to sort of change the look of my book jackets with the final one that I wrote as Lucy Robinson, because there were many elements of the sort of mystery, the blend of mystery and suspense and epic love story of Ghosted. There were many of those elements, I think, in my final Lucy Robinson book. I think it was quite a difficult one for them to jacket. In the same way that I think probably Ghosted was quite a difficult one to jacket, because it does span several genres.
Yeah, it does.
And I think each publisher around the world has had to make their own decisions about which corner of the market they're going to position it at.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about just general sort of, since you've written a number of books now, and I want to talk about good habits that help your writing career, like sleep, for example. And you've got a lot on your plate. Do you have any tips for being your own best friend and taking good care of yourself while you write?
Oh, good.
Yeah, and this is something I have to work on regularly. On my website, I do have a series of tools which are very important to me And I don't really dabble in creative writing tips. It's just not a journey that I've ever been on. It's not something that I've ever felt would be helpful for me. And that's just me. I just work with my gut. But I am quite stringent about discipline and time frames and the state of my writing space and spending a certain amount of time outside each day. All of that stuff is very important to me for my process. But even though I've got that list, which for me is a fail-safe, I do keep having to update it because I think all of writers are a bit crazy. I hope you don't mind me saying that.
No, it's true. It's completely true.
I think it's a very difficult job. We spend a lot of time sitting in a room on our own, not talking to people. And crucially, and I think this is so important, and I go on and on about this, crucially, we don't get feedback that often. I think even if you clean toilets for a living, people say thank you, or they give you a tip. You know, there is some process of feedback, whereas as a writer, you could go months, if not years, without getting feedback from anyone. And I think that that is quite crazy-making, to steal your phrase. And for me, I constantly, you know, it's like having a car. I keep having to go and get it serviced. And so I have a coach who I speak to sometimes who really helps. And just a couple of days ago, we came up with a whole new approach and we worked out specific hours between which I would work each day because I've really struggled as a new mum to make myself sit and write. And not just that, but we came up with a whole load of affirmations as well, mostly to do with confidence and just feeling sort of easy and calm and just trusting myself. I think that's a problem for most writers. Deep down, we don't trust ourselves to get out. You know, for example, when you chop a bit of text out, a bit of prose, I don't know about you too, but I often will like paste that bit of prose into a separate Word document. And it's almost as if I don't trust myself to come up with a great phrase again or a great metaphor. It's bizarre. I'm never going to go into that document again. I'll never use those words. And so that's why I'm trying to use some new affirmations just about trusting myself and just trusting that I'm more than capable and that I've done this quite a few times now. And yeah, that I can do it.
Yeah.
Because I think most of the time, my default is to believe that I can't.
Well, you know, I have a question about that. A lot of us in our past have been bullied. Maybe they were bullied as kids. I know that Gabby Bernstein told us she was called stupid when she was in school, and that was really hard for her. I had some shaming smarty pants girls in high school be really kind of obnoxious with me. And the way I overcame it was I studied writing books relentlessly. So I have a two-pronged question. I'd love to know if you had any bullies in your past who made you feel stupid. And second, which books, if any, made you feel that you could make your writing readable or that you were worthy of being a writer?
Do you mean as in books that I read?
Yeah, writing books. Mine was Elements of Style and the Chicago Manual of Style. I just thought, well, if I learn everything I can about writing, I'm going to feel confident. I'm going to erase those bully voices.
Yes, I was bullied at school, not at primary school. I had a wonderful primary school experience. So that's in the UK, you start school at 4 and you then move on at 11. And that's primary school. And I had a magical time at my primary school. It was a very warm, encouraging place where I was really able to be myself. Secondary school, I turned up. And even though it was a selective grammar school, I was very surprised to discover that it wasn't cool to be successful or clever. It wasn't cool to do your homework or to put your hand up and answer a question that the teacher asked. And I found that to be an incredibly difficult transition. And in the first few weeks, you know, received quite a lot of negative attention from other girls just because I would do things like, you know, when we had assembly in the morning, I would sing. It hadn't occurred to me that singing wasn't cool and that you should just sort of stand there and not sing and just mumble. And so I started out in high school already on a back foot, sort of feeling like it wasn't okay to be myself. And I then just had some really unpleasant up and down friendships over the years with girls. I went to a girls' school, which was challenging, I think. I had friendships with girls. I guess those are my earliest experiences of ghosting. You know, I would be in a friendship group and then would come in the next day to find that nobody in that group was talking to me. And I didn't know why. I didn't know what I'd done. And I remember once, and I can't remember if it was me that this happened to or another girl on our little block of desks. One day, I can't remember if it was me or I think it was her, unfortunately. I think she came in and just found that her desk had been detached from the group and just pushed into the middle of the floor, as in you're not sitting with us anymore. I think girls are incredibly cruel. So cruel. And I really think I found my experience of that was damaging. I should also acknowledge, though, that I dished out some pretty cruel behaviors as well to others. And met somebody a few years ago who said, I hated you at school. You were really horrible. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily just a girls' school thing. I think we just had a very difficult year. My sister went to the same school and had a lovely time in a really nice year group. I think my year was just a difficult year. And right until I left at 18, I had a difficult time. But I'm sure plenty of other people would say that they had a difficult time at my hands too. So, yeah, I have conflicting feelings about school.
I get it.
My coping mechanisms, I would love to say, were something as noble as or creative as writing. They mostly involved eating and sort of finding other roosts over which I could rule in other areas of my life. I did lots of acting, which I think helped because I guess it kind of gave me a bit of attention at a time where I desperately needed somebody to just sort of notice me and validate me. But no, unfortunately, I didn't do any writing at that age at all. Probably it would have been helpful if I had.
Well, I didn't do it in high school either. Well, a little bit.
Oh, you mean as an adult?
But I'm saying as an adult, those voices play, right? I remember I went to my high school reunion and I was like, okay, they're going to be there. And ironically, they couldn't handle the fact that I was published. I wrote a scene about it the other day that's pretty funny. One girl, her head spun around almost like The Exorcist. And she just kept looking at me, well, wait, I don't understand, she kept saying. She basically said, I thought you were an airhead. I thought you were an airhead jock. Like, what the hell? She spit venom at me with her energy because what I would learn later through mutual friends was that she was really having a tough time in her life and unhappy about choices and the way things had happened for her. And I think seeing somebody who she didn't like in high school, somebody who dated the guy that she had had a crush on when they were in elementary school, she didn't like me. Anyway.
I don't think I would go to a high school reunion.
I
kept the friends that I want to keep, and that's fine by me.
Yeah.
In fact, some of them turned up to my really, really old friends who I haven't seen in 20 years turned up to my UK book launch, and it was just so wonderful to see them. None of the ones who give me a hard time, I should add. And it was so lovely to see them, and they were so proud. Oh, it was a wonderful moment.
Well, I think there is something intimidating about writers. Like, I'm intimidated by writers. I couldn't call myself a writer until, like, maybe 7 or 8 months after I was published. I'd already published a book, and someone asked me, what do you do? And it was the first time I said, oh, I'm a writer. And as the word came out of my mouth, I was like, oh, my God, I'm actually saying it, you know? But it takes a while to sort of come into that and just sort of be like, oh, this is what I'm doing. This is my career. I don't know if you feel the same way, Rosie, but there's something about the idea of, like, writing for a living.
Well, I find it really funny that people are so sort of intimidated and amazed by writers. You know, often it's not somebody will ask you what you do. I know when you're starting a new bank account and I'll say I'm a writer and I'll be like, oh, wow. And it's really funny because obviously I know what the reality is, which means, you know, just sitting in a room on my own all day and not talking to anyone and often being completely crazy. But there is just a romance to it because, of course, I remember before I became a writer, just what it felt like to read a book that I adored and to just imagine who wrote this and how and, oh my gosh, where is this mythical person and how can I write to them? Although I do think social media has kind of brought writers out of their ivory tower to a certain extent.
Oh, for sure.
More accessible now and people almost sort of expect to hear back from us. I've had people complain about me because I've not replied to some slightly strange message they've sent me. So yeah, I guess we're becoming less and less mythical. But still, you know, I had so many funny messages from friends after my London book launch last week saying, oh, I can't believe I know a best-selling author, which is funny because they've always known me. It's just a job that I'm doing. I'm no, you know, it's still me.
Oh, that's so good. Hey, one of the questions I get a lot from our listeners is they want to hear more about the deal, like the day they got the book deal. How did that work? How did that feel? Was there an auction? Was it scary? Can you give us a little bit about that day? Well, I guess there were different deals, but tell us about one of them.
My US one, you mean?
Yeah.
So I was on my way to pregnancy Pilates one day, and I don't know what I was thinking of, but I went out without my wallet. I guess I just decided I didn't want to be carrying anything, and so I just took enough money for the bus fare. But I decided I'll walk home. I don't know why, because I was quite heavily pregnant, and it was quite a long way, but anyway. I went out and I came out of pregnancy Pilates. I was at that stage in pregnancy where you just look and feel really fat rather than pregnant. Oh, yeah. And I just felt really heavy and a bit gross and, you know, just a bit meh. It was sort of dark evening. It was January, in the middle of the winter. And I went into a local convenience store to get some water, I think, and check my emails as I was sort of standing at the tills. And I'd been thinking earlier that day that I had sent my manuscript to my US agent weeks before, and I'd made all the changes that she suggested and hadn't heard anything. So I just thought, oh, well, okay, well, I guess nobody wanted to buy the book. I'll probably get the edited highlights for my rejections quite soon. Anyway, I had an email from her saying, I think it was entitled, Oh My God. And she said, I sent your book out last night because we're having a snow day in New York today. And she said, I told editors that if they were going to be at home all day tomorrow, they needed to read this book. This was going to be massive. So then she was saying, I've had editors emailing me since like 2 a.m. She said, they all want to talk to you. They're super excited. She said, when can you get on the phone?
Oh, my God.
She's like, what? And I paid for my water and read it again. And then I realized it was real. And so I was just like, oh my God. So I started typing back, saying, now, tell them to call me Matt now. And of course, at that moment, my phone ran out of battery.
No.
I didn't have my wallet because, as I said earlier, I was just being weird and decided to go out without my wallet. So I had to walk out, shuffle home, heavily pregnant, middle of winter, right across town. Took me a good 40 minutes to get home. And when I finally did get home, I plugged my phone in and I'd already had like three or four more emails saying, oh my God, so-and-so at so-and-so publishing house wants to talk to you. And so-and-so, we're going to have to set up a schedule. And I started shaking at that moment. And that went on for about 3 days. And that night I spoke to two or three, I think, editors. Well, one certainly of whom was just a legendary editor. And I couldn't believe I was on the phone to her. It was ridiculous. And then the next day I had an entire schedule. I had the whole day all planned out by Alison, my American agent. And then I think part of the next day too. And it was completely insane. Alison throughout the whole thing was at home because it was a snow day. She was in her pajamas. We were FaceTiming constantly because neither of us could phone each other because our phone deals wouldn't let us phone internationally. She was in her pajamas, but she had amazing hair because she always has amazing hair. So she looked kind of weirdly glamorous and very scruffy. And we were just kind of screaming at each other on FaceTime in between all of these phone calls.
Oh my God.
And then she sort of was like, right, no, I've got this. I'm very serious about this. I need to talk to all of these people. I'm going to come back to you. And then I think I had about four more in sort of phone chats to go that evening when she FaceTimed me and said, right, I've cancelled those because we have received a preemptive offer that we just cannot possibly ignore. This is like stuff of dreams. And she said, you need to sit down. So I sat down and she told me, and I just didn't talk for ages. And I was like, yeah, but what do you mean? And she kept repeating the amount of money. And I was like, yeah, but what do you mean? I could not take it in. It was so completely preposterous that this would happen to just me, just a sort of chubby, half pregnant woman shuffling around Bristol without her wallet. And she was serious. And I finally took it in and obviously didn't sleep all night. And my partner was away. He was in the Congo filming with a tribe. And it really reminded me that actually, it doesn't matter what you get in your career, a no book deal really means anything. Because the next day, all I could think about was, I can't remember the last time I felt my baby move.
Oh.
And also, why hasn't my partner called me in days? Because he had a satellite phone and he should have been calling. And he normally does call like every other day when he's in somewhere like that.
Right.
And he hadn't called in several days. And so I called the company that were in charge of all the logistics and safety, and they said, we've been getting sort of automated messages to say they're safe, but we haven't actually spoken to anyone for a few days, but we'll pass on the message. And then I just kept calling them over the next few days, and they kept saying, well, we've been sending the messages, but nobody's answering.
Oh my God.
But we have continued to receive the message saying that everything's okay. So obviously in my head, they'd been abducted, and the bandits who'd taken them were kind of making them send the automated message saying everything's fine, so no help would be sent. Turns out they were fine. It's just they weren't leaving their phones on long enough to receive those messages. They were turning them on for 2 seconds, sending the message. Signal was too poor for them to bother trying to call anyone, so they just didn't. Yeah. And of course, my baby was fine. He'd just been eating adrenaline for a few days. And he was having a well-earned sleep. I always sort of, when I tell the tale, I always talk about that because actually, I'm sure it would be easy to kind of hear what happened and think, oh, God, that's never going to happen to me. And oh, man, that's so unfair. I hate Ghosted. It's such an awful book. Why did that happen to her? She's a terrible writer. And, you know, obviously people are welcome to think that. That's fine. But actually, I think the important thing is to remember is none of it makes any difference, really.
Oh, isn't that the case? It's so the case. My fiance is a big hiker, and we go on these massive hikes, and sometimes he goes without me, and he'll be way up in the mountain somewhere, and I don't hear from him, and it's in those moments where, you know, there's a wildfire nearby, and you think maybe a hunter accidentally shot him, and there's so many things that go, and you hear about other hikers who fall and die or whatever. And in every case, every time that's happened over the last 8 years, it's happened a couple of times, nothing else matters. It's when you go, this is all I care about.
The only thing that could possibly matter. My family. Yeah. The only thing that could possibly matter, the people you love.
Yeah.
But, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's not the kind of thing that is going to occur to you, is it? All you're really thinking about is...
Aditi, I want to talk about your first book deal because I was there. My God, that was exciting. The book was Mirror in the Sky. At the time, it was called Terra Nova, and you were sending me a chapter a day. So Aditi and I were new friends. It was so odd. We met at a Liz Gilbert event in Malibu. And we just clicked instantly, and she starts telling me about this thing that she's working on. And I never, ever do this, Rosie. I never say to a complete stranger, oh, send it to me. Let me give you notes. Like, never do I do that because I don't have time. I'm always trying to finish my own books. And I have lots of people that I help who come to my retreats. So never do I do that. Just she sends me a couple chapters, and I'm so riveted. And I'm on a deadline, a book deadline. I cannot read anymore. I can read only 2 chapters. And I was so blown away. I was like, who the hell are you? And I have to help you. So I sent it to my agent. My agent wasn't interested but loved it. They sent it to another agent. Then I just got pissed and I started sending it to multiple agents. Anyway, it wasn't the right book at the right time. But about 6 months later, I hadn't heard anything from her. I didn't know what was happening. And I was like, whatever happened to that author? She's so good. She needs to be published. So I emailed her. I said, what is happening? And she said, well... I've written another one. Okay, this is how Aditi does things. She just like sneezes and she writes a novel, right? So she goes, oh, I've written another one. It's called Terra Nova. And she tells me the blurb on it sounded amazing. I said, send it to me. But this time, just send me a chapter a day. That's all I can handle, but I can handle that. So she sends me a chapter. I'm like, this is good. She sends me another chapter. I'm freaking out.
You are amazing. You gave me such good notes on that manuscript. I looked forward to your notes every day. They were so, so good.
It was so easy because you're so good. And then her agent starts sending it out. And I hadn't talked with her in a while. But I have a bottle of perfume. I haven't seen it in years. I don't even know where it is. All my perfume is in a drawer in my closet. One day I wake up. This is no lie, you guys. My perfume is on my counter. And there's only one bottle on my counter. I didn't put it there. And I look at the label. I'm like, what is this perfume? And it says Terra Nova. That's the name.
No, come on.
Of her novel, which changed to Mirror in the Sky. But at the time, that's the name of her novel. I call her up and I go, you're getting a deal today or tomorrow. She goes, what? I said, yeah. And I told her how I knew. And she goes, that's the weirdest shit. And then it happened.
The next day, I got a book deal. Yes, it was during the auction process. And basically the next day, I got a call from my lovely editor who was like, you know, you just, my editor and I, we had this, the first time we spoke, we talked for like 4 hours on the phone and we talked about movies and we talked about other books that we loved. And I was like, oh my God, she's the one. And I really, really wanted her to give me a book deal and she had the highest offer. So she's the one I went with, but it was literally the day after you found that perfume bottle. So I was like, oh, now you need to give me a sign on my next
that's
book.
That's freaky shit. That's amazing though. God, that's proper, hairs on the back of neck.
Right? It was just weird because here she is writing a novel about another planet and how it mirrors our own. And here on this planet, some major magic happened in my bathroom.
It was very magical. It was very, very magical.
Oh my God, Aditi, I'm going to have to order your books immediately.
Immediately.
I've never heard such amazing sales.
I'm so intimidated though because your book just, I like sobbed at the end of it. You have no idea. I was like in tears.
Thank you, guys.
Well, I sobbed at both of your books, so there. But yeah, I mean, how do you... Okay, so let's talk craft for a little minute from both of you. How do you write a book that is suspenseful and heartfelt and riveting? How do you do that? And I think that's been the age-old question in publishing from the beginning. How do you write a page-turner? So if you could tell us in a couple of sentences, both of you, how do you do it? What's your secret?
You go first, Aditi.
I think if you're bored writing it, people are going to be bored reading it. So sometimes, right. Like when I do the plotting, if I have certain scenes where I'm like, oh, and then there's going to be this painful conversation between the dad and the daughter. And as I'm writing it, I'm like, oh God, this is a horrible conversation. Nobody wants to read it. I don't want to write it. If I'm not excited about writing it, I know it's not going to be good. But sometimes I'm writing a scene and I'm laughing out loud because I'm like, this is so funny. Or I'm writing a scene and I'm literally tearing up. I really sort of dig and mine my own experiences for my own writing. And I mine the most painful, horrible shit that nobody wants to think about. Like all the horrific things that have happened to me, but also all the really magical things that have happened to me. And I think the crazy making aspect of writing is you have to sort of go into your most painful and most euphoric experiences. And that makes for good writing, it makes for good reading, and the boring stuff nobody really wants to hear, and you don't want to write it. So that's usually my marker.
Interesting. Gosh. For me, it's quite a slow process of layering, really. I often am quite bored by what I'm writing, but I go back again and again and again and again. It's kind of like using post-it notes to plot, you know, say yellow is your main storyline and orange is your red herrings or something. You look at an area and you're like, there's not enough oranges here. I just know when there's not enough tension or enough pace or whatever. And so I layer it in again and again. And the only problem with that approach is that I find it very hard to let go of the book at the end. And I did find it quite hard to let go of this one because I just kept thinking, but I can add another layer of suspense in. And, you know, of course, it's fine. But yeah, layering for me is the only way to create a page turner because actually the way I write is very slow and laborious. I edit heavily as I go. Sadly, I'm not one of those writers who can just knock out a novel and then edit it. So it's just layer after layer after layer after layer.
Yeah, I edit it, just
listening to my gut.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any secrets about getting through that messy middle when you're stuck? You know, you started off strong, you know essentially where you're going in the end, but you're just slogging through the middle. Any advice?
I think that's when you need tools and that's when you need help. You need structure, I think, for me. Mm-hmm. You need somebody to be saying to you, this is what you're going to do today. Check in with me. Or, you know, or I guess you're an adult. You say, this is what I need to be doing today. And then just have somebody to check in with and say, yes, I did that today. And even if you're sitting at your desk for 6 hours and you don't really write anything, you're just fiddling with a bit or something. I think that's it. It's just showing up each day, sitting down and doing it. And also, above all, I guess, just being honest with yourself. If you're really struggling, it's probably because what you're doing isn't working and you need to unpick a lot and probably lose a lot of words. So honesty and bravery.
Now, when you
When
you say check in with people, do you have a writing buddy? Did you have an accountability buddy? Did you have a writing group?
I have a writing partner. And when I first started to realize that not just lack of feedback, but the solitude of writing, how it was impacting on my emotional health, I decided I had to do something about it. And I decided I wanted a writing partner. And I asked a few trusted writer friends. They all said no, because, you know, they're all too busy writing and felt that sort of a process of regular feedback would be more than they could commit to. And I was beginning to give up in despair. And then I went to a friend's 40th birthday. And there was a girl there who I had had a few conversations via email with. We'd sort of worked together on a book competition judging. And she said, basically, I've decided to quit my job and just write my book. I have to just do this. And I said, oh, great. You know, good luck. How are you feeling about it? And she said, well, terrified. And she said, look, I know you don't really know me, but is there any way you'd be willing to sort of give me some advice or take a look at it or just point me in the right direction or anything? And this was a crucial bit. She said, I don't quite know what I can offer you in return. But I'd be glad to, you know, I have a coaching background as well as English teaching. And, you know, I'd obviously happily look at any of your words, although I'm sure you wouldn't want my opinion. And I knew that I actually did want her opinion because we worked together before on a project. And I thought she was just an incredibly astute reader. And I said to her straight away, I was like, oh, my God, yes, 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 I want to work with you. And actually, you have more to offer me than you could possibly imagine. Would you be interested in fortnightly meetings on Skype because she lives abroad? And so we meet fortnightly on Wednesdays and we send each other our material by Monday night latest. And we send with whatever words it is we need help with, we'll send a few questions or a steer. And then we'll meet for normally 2 hours, occasionally longer, on a Wednesday morning. We'll spend roughly an hour on each manuscript. And
Oh, gosh, it's been transformative, actually, because no matter how much I'm struggling with my own manuscript, I can always give helpful feedback on hers. And that reminds me that I am a writer and a storyteller, not a failure. And likewise, no matter how much I'm struggling with my novel, she's always got really helpful feedback, and she's got me out of so many holes. You know, so many great bits of Ghosted are courtesy of her, things she suggested, or said, why don't you try writing this? Or just even little lines that she tweaked with.
What you're doing, if you're meeting Fortnite in the States, we call it every 2 weeks, but if you're meeting every 2 weeks, you know that you have to deliver. So you get those sections readier than you would if you're just working on your own timeline. That can be really slow.
Yes.
Yeah, I like it.
It's accountability as much as everything, which, you know, takes me back to the question you originally asked. That's my main checking in, is with my writing partner. And with this novel that I'm writing at the moment, I've had many weeks where I've said I just haven't written anything, and that's been quite painful. But she's been very encouraging through that. But yeah, it's accountability as much as anything else. It's actually having something to send somebody rather than yet again going, I haven't done anything.
Oh, I love it. I have a membership group called the Beautiful Writers Group, and Danielle Laporte and I started it with the tagline, friends don't let their friends write alone. And it was for that very reason, because we're all so isolated, and it's just so helpful to be able. And not only that, we have this Facebook group, a private one, where people chime in all the time and say, hey, I have a question. Do you guys like this title? Or I just wrote this blog and I need some advice, or can you guys follow me on Twitter or whatever it is? But it's just way less isolating. And we keep it really inexpensive because writers don't usually have very much money, but it's just a place where you're not by yourself. Rosie, I wanted to ask, just Evernote, Grammarly, Scrivener, Google Docs, any sort of tech secret weapons that help you stay organized while you work?
No. Oh, God, I wish I was able to use these things. And I'm able to use these things. I just never found the time to sit down and work them out. So many people have told me that Scrivener is just the way forward. But the idea of trying to figure it out just fills me with horror. So if anyone listening wants to talk me through it, I mean, please just give me a call.
GwenHernandez.com. She taught me. I mean, I was struggling with Scrivener. I'd used it for years because it helps you organize characters and plots and everything. And I had gone only so far with it. And I went online and I checked. She wrote Scriveners for Dummies. So I just hired her for an hour. And I'm telling you, my binders are on my computer. They're on my phone. It's so easy. I can find anything immediately. I mean,
Scrivener.com
and GwenHernandez.com. I cannot.
Okay.
I cannot. And I get nothing, no kickback. It's just because. Aditi, what do you use to stay organized?
Oh, I am so basic when it comes to this stuff. I just literally use a Word document. And I have a postcard system or like a note card system for my outlines. And that's literally it. I'm so basic. I've tried the Scrivener stuff, but ultimately I just sort of, for me, it's like so just coming to the page every day, writing 1,000 words a day. And sometimes it's a tough day and sometimes it isn't. But that's literally all. It's so simple. It just keeps things simple and easy for me. And that's all I can handle on most days.
I got it. Okay, so Rosie, is there anything you want to say before we go?
Just thank you so much. It's been so fascinating to talk to you both, and I can't wait to read both of you. It's, gosh, what a lot of talent on one phone call, and I'm not including myself in that.
Oh, you need to, because your book is so fun. Oh, I'm so glad you wrote it, and congratulations, and happy book birthday.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you, Rosie. Big hug.
Okay,
lots of love. And when you come to LA, we'll take you to lunch. So let us know whenever you're
here. Oh, my God, I'm so up for that.
Okay, love.
So up for that. All right.
Bye, sweetheart.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us. What a blast. You can find Rosie over at rosiewalsh.com and Aditi at aditikarana.com with links to all their social media. Keep an eye out for news on their books being adapted for the screen as well. Both Aditi's novels have been optioned for films, and it's very exciting. I wish I could say more now, but the upcoming Beautiful Writers book, which is very much in process, will have stories like these that we couldn't cover on the show. I'll keep you posted on release dates ASAP. As for your writing, for $25 a month, you can kiss isolation and that wacky, lonely writer's brain we talked about earlier goodbye by joining me in the Beautiful Writers Group. Aside from the camaraderie and intellectual connection, much like this podcast, there's a library of expert interviews there that you can listen to anytime on subjects like bolstering your Amazon.com reviews, growing your email list, signing with agents and navigating the sales process, overcoming fear, finding beta readers. Acclaimed author Samantha Bennett is my partner in our monthly Q&A calls, and she just interviewed Sean Pratt, one of the most prolific audiobook narrators in the biz, having recorded nearly 1,000 books. This October, I'll be interviewing Leah Kameko to share everything we can throw at her about her decades of publishing successful, as in profitable, children's books. Again, that's at beautifulwritersgroup.com. Or you can find links to everything in the Book Mama universe, including info on my very small and super effective writing retreats in Carmel for the week of September 3rd and October 22nd. That's all at the bottom of the website for beautifulwriterspodcast.com. Oh my God, still with me? Thank you so, so much. And thanks to all of you who've left us love over on iTunes. Your 5-star appreciation is so appreciated. Okay, until next time, write on.